And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. You've heard me say it on the program before, and I will say it again. One of my greatest pleasures in hosting the morning show is when I get to talk with first-rate documentarians about wonderful documentaries. And even apart from the radio station, I love taking in documentaries. But it is especially fun to be able to be taken behind the scenes by whoever has written or produced or directed it. And in this case, I am so excited to be reconnecting with Stephen Ives, with whom I've spoken on several different occasions on the morning show about some of the wonderful films that he has put together. One of the first times we talked was about his lovely American Experience documentary about the great racing horse Seabiscuit. And I know we have spoken as well about films like The Roads to Memphis, as well as his series The Great War, focusing on World War I. He did a marvelous film collaborating with Ken Burns, a series devoted to the West. And his latest film is absolutely fascinating, and also the kind of film that unearths for us a fascinating story that most of us know absolutely nothing about. The film is titled Ruthless: Monopoly's Secret History. And Monopoly, and we are talking about the board game, the beloved board game, maybe the best-selling board game in history. And this film uncovers its really complicated and even troubling history. And this film will air Monday night on PBS stations across the country, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee, as part of the American Experience series. And I'm excited to speak with Stephen Ives, who is both writer and director of this marvelous film. Stephen Ives, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Hi, Greg. Great to talk to you again.
I'm really, really excited about this. I want to just clarify something real quick. You are the writer and the director. I think you're not the producer of this film. Is that right?
No, the producer is my longtime fantastic partner, Amanda Pollock.
Terrific. Can you kind of separate that out for us? And maybe the line is a relatively blurred one, but I'm just really curious to know what her duties are as producer versus yours as director, and to what extent you are typically in very close collaboration with one another on a film like Ruthless.
Yeah, Amanda is the sort of the definition of an incredibly engaged, creative producer. I mean, on one level, she handles logistics and contracts and legal issues and the budget, and that's an essential thing that a producer needs to do, and she's also really involved in mapping out production, which can be sometimes an extremely complex logistical operation. But a good producer like Amanda also is deeply invested in the story. She understands the way in which films need to be structured. She's engaged in the editing room. She has really thoughtful ideas about character and story development, about interviews and about how they should be used. So it's a really wonderfully spirited and when it works well, which it does with Amanda all the time, just a deeply rewarding collaboration. And I love the fact that we have such a close connection and have made so many interesting films together.
I know that I have talked to documentarians who have been both director and producer of a given film, and I don't know how common or uncommon that is. Do you ever wear the mantle of producer as well as director, or by and large are you happiest with what happened in this film where you are directing and those producer duties are someone else's responsibility?
I've done it all, you know. I've been producer, director, and writer at times, which is a lot to put on your plate. But that's an interesting challenge as well. I mean, I'm happiest writing and directing. I think I know what I'm best at, and I can produce films, but it's not my strength. I'm nowhere near as good a producer as Amanda is, and so when I can avail myself of her talents, it's a much stronger combination.
Very good. Well, this is a terrific film. I absolutely loved it, and I think I am going to be like the typical viewer in knowing absolutely nothing about this story. And, you know, of course, that's not always the case. I mean, when you're doing a film about, for instance, the racing horse Seabiscuit, most of us, as we turned on our televisions, had at least a vague notion of Seabiscuit. And, of course, most of us have some acquaintance with the game of Monopoly. But this story of its, in a sense, kind of cloudy origins is something that was absolutely unknown to me. How did you first come across this particular story? I mean, the complicated origins of Monopoly. How did this story initially cross your path?
Well, it's so funny. It was 18 years ago, and I can't remember exactly how it popped onto my radar, but I came across a book called The Billion Dollar Monopoly Swindle, and it was written by this guy named Ralph Anspach, and he was this guy who he was an economics professor out in California. He got wrapped up in a lawsuit with Parker Brothers, and over the course of his lawsuit, uncovered this entire secret history that no one had really known before. And I looked at it and thought, that is just so ridiculous. I mean, how could we have not known about this? In particular, because the heroine of the story is a woman who actually invented the game in 1904. And for a complicated set of reasons, the film never got off the ground back in 2005. But I managed to shoot an interview with Ralph in New York City because I just felt like it was such an important story. I didn't want to have it get away from me. And 18 years later, the American Experience loved the idea and said, let's do it. And luckily, I hadn't lost the tape. So I was able to weave that historical interview with Ralph through the film, and he's kind of like the central motivating force in some ways around the story.
If I understand correctly, Ralph Anspach passed away in the spring of last year. Was he in a position to see at least some of what you had done? He would have been well into his 90s, I think, by that point. Was he aware that this film was finally being made?
No, I'm so sorry to report that he passed away just as we were getting started. And it's really too bad because he would have loved this. He was a wonderful guy. I admire him tremendously. And he had great conviction and really, he was just a brave, sometimes stubborn, but really a moral guy who took on this struggle, very much a David and Goliath struggle against Parker Brothers and General Mills, the serial conglomerate that had bought Parker Brothers in the 70s and 80s. And he's a great American, I think. And we're lucky enough to have been able to get his story from him while he was still alive.
Hmm. There are a lot of stories that are interesting, but that doesn't necessarily mean that a documentary film should be made about them. Tell us what you found not only compelling about this story, but also convinced you that you could really make an excellent film about it. I mean, what kind of things does one have to weigh when you're in the business of making documentary films in terms of whether or not this is that kind of story that should be told in this kind of way?
Well, it's a very practical and good question, Greg. I mean, you have to kind of be realistic about whether it's a visual medium, and is there anything to look at? And in this case, I was convinced that Monopoly was such a kind of iconic part of American culture that there'd be all sorts of material out there about the game and how we play it and what our relationship with it is. And that proved to be true. And also, I knew that since I first met Ralph, this woman, Mary Pollan, had written a best-selling book called The Monopolists. And she really broke the story to a broad audience, and I give her great credit for it. It was a best-selling book, and she is a fantastic writer and really smart, and I knew she'd give me a great interview. And I felt like between her and Ralph, there was certainly going to be enough material to really crack this open. And I felt like Monopoly was this lens through which it was a way to understand and look at American capitalism in such an interesting way. I mean, because everything that you think of about our system, greed, competition, ruthlessness, even fraud and corporate kind of skullduggery, it's all wrapped up in this one story. And it just felt like such an interesting way to take a look at who we are as a country and what we believe. And if you think about it, I mean, there isn't anything quite like monopoly that we sort of put on an altar and bow down in front of and celebrate this unbridled capitalism. It's like this national shrine to a kind of winner-take-all economic system. And I just felt like that was really worth unpacking and exploring a little bit.
We're speaking with Stephen Ives, who is a writer and director for the next film to air in the PBS series American Experience, a really fascinating film called Ruthless, Monopoly's Secret History. It explores the really tangled origin story of the board game Monopoly and views it through several different lenses. Before we get into the heart of the story of this board game, I think it would be interesting for us to talk for a few minutes about this whole business of monopolies, of what a monopoly is, and what I think is pretty clearly your own perspective on monopolies and whether they tend to be a force for good or ill in the world. Let's begin with just that notion, maybe even a pretty careful definition of what we mean by a monopoly, and then what you touch on in the film at the outset, which is the place of powerful monopolies in our country's history.
Yeah, well, monopolies are very much something that most businesses, if they are honest with themselves, want. It's the ability to dominate a market, dominate a means of production, dominate pricing, dominate your competition to a degree that you own an entire sphere of the economy. And Standard Oil was one, AT&T was one in its day. Huge companies that basically don't have to worry about competition. And I think I agree with Ralph Ansbach, who hated monopolies and who felt like he was dealing with the OPEC oil monopoly in the 70s, which we all remember if we're old enough. And, monopolies are just bad for a well-functioning economy. They create an unlevel playing field. And there's something that the country as a whole, I think, needs to be really vigilant about, because we talk a big game about being all in favor of, competition and the freedom of the marketplace. But if we're not proactive about antitrust issues and about companies getting overwhelmingly powerful in one sphere or another, we're going to lose out. I mean, I don't know whether you followed the recent Taylor Swift concert tour debacle, where Live Nation basically has a complete monopoly on major concert venues. And it's something that Congress is looking at right now. But it took a kind of chaos in Taylor Swift's most recent concert tour to kind of bring that to people's attention.
Hmm. Early in the film, a really kind of starkly stated sentence we hear is, capitalists don't like competition. They want a monopoly. That is, for those who believe at least in a certain brand of maybe pure capitalism, or maybe, I don't know if pure is maybe the right adjective, but unbridled capitalism, let's say, in a sense, a monopoly is what you want. That is, in a sense, the ultimate goal. Maybe that's a marker of the ultimate success in a capitalist system.
Well, in some ways, I mean, you want to rise to the top. You want to have the best product. You want to control the marketplace as best you can. And look, I don't blame executives from CEOs from driving their companies forward and trying to make them the best that they can be. It's just a question of when does an overwhelming dominance actually stop serving the consumer? And in this case, Ralph he decided to come up with a game, a board game in the 70s that he called Anti-Monopoly. And he felt like a game needed to be out there that sort of showed the other side of the story. And to his surprise, at that point, General Mills sent him a nasty letter and said, you've got to stop publishing your game. You've got to destroy all the copies you have because you're infringing on our trademark. And Ralph, you know, if it was you or me, Greg, you get a scary letter from a multinational corporation like that, you're likely to just say, okay, I'll do whatever you say. But he said no, and he fought them. And he fought them for over a decade, all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States, and emerged victorious. And in the course of that crusade, he uncovered the fact that the game had been in the public domain, and that it had been invented by a woman in 1904. It hadn't been invented by Charles Darrow, the supposed inventor, in 1935 during the Great Depression.
Mm. One of the really striking moments in the film, this is before we're even getting into the specific story of the board game, is when you're talking about the problem with monopolies, and you show us some starkly contrasting photographs of certain images of America, I would presume, close to the turn of the century, to really kind of point out the wrenching differences between the haves and the have-nots. I mean, something which, of course, we are very much talking about today. In some respects, it is even a more extreme situation that we're talking about at this period of time. Just explain to our listeners the striking visuals that you as director chose to kind of serve up this contrast.
Well, I mean, they're wonderful to behold. I mean, the robber barons, as they were called that era, were just extraordinarily wealthy. I mean, what's amazing is that Elon Musk's wealth dwarfs the wealth of J.P. Morgan and Andrew Carnegie and Rockefeller as a percentage. But these guys were tremendously powerful. They perfected the look of the top hat and the elegant waistcoat and the fantastic limousines. And they were presiding over a country that was emerging from the Gilded Age, where income inequality had become perverse. And the vast majority of working men and women were living in, if they were in cities, in horrible tenements. A lot of them were immigrants who'd come to America with very little to begin with. And it was this condition, this sense of inequality, that inspired the inventor of Monopoly, Lizzie McGee, to first try and articulate her economic message through the power of a board game.
Hmm.
Go ahead. I'll tell you about Henry George if you'd like, because he's a fascinating guy.
Right. We need to learn about both of them. Lizzie J. Let's actually begin with Lizzie, born in 1866. Yes. She is a remarkable woman in so many respects, and very much out of the ordinary in just about any way that you can imagine. Tell us a little bit about her early background and some of the striking things that she did before we ultimately get to Chicago and her encounter with Henry George and so on. But tell us about the early life of Lizzie McGee.
She was raised in Macomb, Illinois. She was the child of a successful newspaper publisher who was a friend of the young Abraham Lincoln at the time when Lincoln was traveling around doing his debates with Stephen Douglas. And she was raised in a very smart, interesting family, and she was a feminist. She was an inventor. She had a patent for helping. She was a typist. She filed a patent for helping an invention to help typewriters manage the paper in the carriage return better. But more than that, she was pushing boundaries. She bristled at the way in which women were treated in her society, and she draw attention to this, created a advertisement that she put in news local papers in which she advertised herself as a young American woman slave. And it was clearly a piece of performance art. It was designed to provoke and shock people. But of course, she got offers.
Right.
People offered to take her on, to buy her. And her point was to try and highlight the inequality that she felt between the sexes and the way in which women's latitude and opportunity to move forward in their lives was constrained. And she was featured in big magazine and newspaper spreads. She was really a sort of celebrity in a way in her day because she was so out there. And I just love her for it.
Absolutely. I mean, and even when one knows something about the history of feminism and the battle for equal rights and for women to achieve the vote and so on, even if one is fairly well read in that struggle, you might not yet know the name of Lizzie McGee, but she is someone who absolutely should not be forgotten. Your film tells us that by early in the 20th century, she is living in Chicago, and that's where she takes out these ads with the headline "Young Woman for Sale," and ultimately she encounters one Henry George. Tell us about Henry George, who he was, and in a sense, the principles he stood for.
Well, Henry George was an extremely popular writer and lecturer of the day. His books sold millions of copies. And he believed that the problem with inequality in America came down to taxes and land. He felt like landlords who sat on property and benefited from them but didn't do anything with that land were basically exploiting a resource that was part of the common good. And he felt that a single tax on land was the only tax necessary, and that money should be used to pay for schools and public works and all sorts of things to create a more just and equitable society. And he was a kind of a precursor of the socialist movement in America. And Lizzie McGee followed his single tax beliefs and felt very much that he was, you know, her hero. And the purpose of her game was to try and popularize his single tax theories.
So it's such an intriguing idea to think about this principle that is a little bit complicated. I mean, the name does not immediately suggest what it really is, but she has this insight that a board game could help people kind of understand and grasp this. If I remember correctly, she's the first woman in America to gain a patent on a board game, and her board game is called, as you said, the Landlord's Game. And tell us about the dual set of rules, which is a really unique feature to the game and really points to what the point of it was as far as she was concerned.
Yeah, her first set of rules was basically the game that we recognize as Monopoly. Buy all the property, crush the competition, and the winner is the last person standing. And she meant that to be a way of showing off how brutal and unfair capitalism was. And the great irony is that her critique of capitalism turned out, in our hands, to be a celebration of it. The other set of rules was a more complicated set of rules where you played, your goal was to sort of break up monopolies and contribute to the common good, and it was quite complicated to follow, and not surprisingly, it didn't catch on. The one that did is the one that we play today. But she did understand that games are powerful. That games, when you play a game, there's a subtle but important way in which you're inculcating values and ideas and impressions in the play of the game that may not be completely. You might not be completely aware of them, but you really are being changed by them. And she felt that a game, and I think that's in many ways one of the things that makes Monopoly interesting, is that it subtly or not so subtly inculcates in all of us this celebration of American capitalism, perhaps maybe an unthinking celebration of American capitalism. So games have power. They have... the ability to change people's minds, and Lizzie tried to capitalize on it.
Right. And you know, and you're pointing to something that's really interesting. I mean, I suppose on the one hand, somebody could say the typical American loves capitalism, so the typical American is going to love Monopoly, playing Monopoly, and relishing that experience. What you are suggesting is something related but different, which is that in the act of playing Monopoly, one is going to very likely find your attitudes about capitalism, for instance, guided, tilted in a certain direction.
Yeah, I mean, I think I don't want to be some, you know, super wet blanket. I mean, look, everybody loves Monopoly. I love playing it as a game. It's wonderful. It's part of our culture. It's part of our nostalgia. It's a rite of passage. It's almost like we hand it off to our kids. It's like when your kids get old enough, you wonder whether you can finally give them the first, you know, the Beatles album, or when they can go to Disney World. It's one of these iconic things. And I think it's a great part of American culture. But at the same time, I think it's important to realize it's really based on this sort of mythic vision of America. I mean, if you think about it, you start a game of Monopoly, everybody gets the same amount of money. Everybody has access to the bank whenever they need it. Everyone, the winner is the person who thinks that they play the game the best way. And we know that the real playing field is not level like that, that there are all sorts of issues having to do with race and gender and inherited money and luck that play into who comes out on top. And I think that that's an important thing just to remember when you think about the game.
So it's important for us to understand about this early game created by Lizzie McGee in terms of who was playing it and, in a sense, how this game spread. I mean, in the early going, was this a game that was, in a sense, published and sold the way we think of games being published, you know, made in a factory and duplicated and sold? Your film talks mostly about how it was, in a sense, spread almost like a folk tale with interesting variations and so on. So just help us understand kind of the early life of this game that Lizzie McGee created.
Well, it was almost an early version of what we now think of as a viral phenomenon, but it was very limited in its scale. I mean, Lizzie just invented it, spread it around to her liberal, left-leaning group of people who were Henry George followers and socialists. And it started to catch on in liberal college campuses, and it just spread from one group to another. And one thing that everyone would do is that they would customize the board and put their own street names on it and add little ideas that they had. And it just kept moving around the East Coast until a group of Quakers got the game, and they had a significant presence in Atlantic City, and they were the ones that added the Atlantic City names, street names that have become iconic for us, Baltic and Mediterranean, Boardwalk and Park Place. And they were the ones that also added hotels to the game, because a lot of Quakers owned hotels in Atlantic City. That was a big business for them. And they were the ones that kind of gave the game its iconic place that we all think of and know today.
This was a surprise to me when you mentioned these Quakers in Atlantic City, just because, I mean, I don't claim to know a lot about the Quaker faith, but I would not have assumed that it would be a group of Quakers who would latch on to this game and, in a sense, transform it into the form in which it is familiar to all of us today. Is there something about the Quaker faith that makes it kind of an easy and seamless transition? Or were these just a bunch of Quakers who just happened to like Monopoly?
Well, it's a kind of interesting story. I mean, I'm a Quaker on my mother's side, and it's an interesting thing, and because I'm both a Quaker, so that's a connection to the story, and also my great-great-grandfather was the first publisher of the first board game in America back in 1843.
Wow.
In Salem, Massachusetts, a really boring game called The Mansion of Happiness.
You show us that in the film. We see an image of that, I think.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If you look carefully, I snuck the Ives building in Salem, Massachusetts into that sequence. But so it sort of comes to me oddly from both sides of my family. But Quakers were, an unlikely group of people that you'd think of in Atlantic City, which was before Las Vegas, was the vacation playground in America. And they were teetotalers, and so it's hard to imagine that they were, tailor-made for a city like Atlantic City. But they were good businessmen, and they happened to get into the hotel business. And so they had quite a significant community in Atlantic City. And when they brought the game with them from Philadelphia down to Atlantic City, they started to customize it and add the color codings and add some of the iconic tokens that we now think of, like the thimble, or they would use anything that they had locally that they could use, like a button or something, as a token to move around the board. It's funny because it's something we go into a little bit in the film, which is that the Quakers inadvertently create a kind of a snapshot of race and class in Atlantic City, because we have to remember it was a deeply segregated city back then. We always like to think of the North as being less encumbered by racism than the South, but it couldn't be farther from the truth. The Atlantic City was a deeply racist place, and Baltic and Mediterranean were the black parts of town. They were the least valuable properties, and that's what the Quakers reflected when they put Baltic and Mediterranean on the board, and then parts of the board, like Boardwalk and Park Place, were the richest parts of town. And so in an interesting way, you see a little bit of a reflection of redlining and racial disparity reflected in America's favorite board game.
Fascinating. We're speaking with Stephen Ives about his film Ruthless, Monopoly's Secret History. So we fast forward to the mid-1930s and to what had been for many years presented as the origin story of Monopoly. In fact, there's a great little moment early in the film in which we see a little bit of animation done sort of in the style of the visuals that we see in some of the cards in the Monopoly game. And as we see what was supposedly the origins of this game, remind our listeners about the man to whom the invention of Monopoly was credited for so many years.
Charles Darrow was an out-of-work radiator repairman in the depths of the Depression. And one day he bumps into a friend who is a part of this Quaker community, and he and his wife go over and play Monopoly with them. And he loves the game, and he asks for a copy of the rules, and they give it to him. And he then takes the game and, in effect, steals the game and markets it himself and claims that he's the inventor. And to his credit, he adds some of the artwork that we think of as sort of iconic on the board right now, the free parking space and some of the other look and feel of the game. And he's successful. He gets it into Wanamaker's department store in Philadelphia. He gets it into FAO Schwartz. He takes it to Parker Brothers, and they turn him down because they think it's too complicated. But as it starts to take off, Parker Brothers suddenly says, wait a minute, maybe we overlooked something. And they go back, and they buy it, and they confront Darrow, and they say, now, you're the inventor of this game, right? And he says, oh, yes, absolutely. I dreamed it up one night in my basement. And that is the myth that Parker Brothers and Darrow spin for the next 70 years.
Hmm.
It is, well, maybe not 70 because Ralph comes along in the 70s, so maybe for another, 40 years, that's the reigning idea, that Darrow is this rags-to-riches inventor, this Horatio Alger hero, who picks himself up by his own bootstraps and has this burst of inspiration and creates America's favorite board game.
By the way,
it's a narrative that Americans wanted to hear. You know, it was a powerful message in the Depression, and Parker Brothers just wrote it all the way to the bank.
Mm. And that speaks to something else I wanted to say, which is that apparently the initial reluctance for game manufacturers like Parker Brothers to take on this game was because at least their initial thought was, it's the Depression. Who in the world, who in their right mind would want to play a game that has to do with winning money and building hotels and owning property and all of this stuff, which was in such stark contrast to the reality of most Americans' daily lives. And I think at some point somebody figured out that actually a lot of times we play games not because they reflect what our lives are like, but because they sometimes reflect what we wish our lives were like or give us a chance
right.
to escape the reality of our lives.
Yeah, it's just like Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers dancing in white tie and tails during the dark days of the Depression. I mean, it's and games are like that. Games are full of role-playing. They're full of fantasy. They're full of you're allowed to take on a different persona and act in ways that you might not act outside of the context of a game. And I think that that's one of the great, powerful things that is appealing about Monopoly. I mean, who doesn't love crushing their older brother or older sister at Monopoly? Who doesn't love being the, unbridled capitalist who's out there destroying the competition? It's an exhilarating and fun thing to do, and you get rich.
Hmm.
And I think Americans, especially in the Depression, just really needed that release, and it's part of the reason the game had such a powerful appeal.
You know, I'm just, as you're talking about that, I'm realizing something that I don't think otherwise I would have paused to articulate. But one really nice through line in your film is that there is a group of youngsters, I don't remember, 4, 5, 6 youngsters, that are playing the game. And every so often, it's as though our camera kind of swings back to these youngsters playing a very spirited game of Monopoly and very demonstrative in, you know, when they're happy versus when they're anguished, as depending on how their fortunes in the game proceed. And I'm guessing these maybe are the kids of some of the people involved in the making of this film. Maybe some of them are your own kids or something. But I love that presence because it kind of gives us a sense of, for people who are swept up in playing this game, whether they're adults or children, that is part of what hooks us.
Yeah, it's actually Amanda Pollock, my producer's son, and his friends from school. And you're right. I wanted to do that because I wanted to touch on what is everyone's memory of playing the game, which is that sense of rivalry and chance. And there's that moment when people are waiting to roll the dice and, are you going to land on my hotel on Boardwalk? And it's really fun. And I wanted to just harken back to everyone's nostalgia about the game and also provide a little sort of tableau that reminds us what play of the game is. Because a game, I learned this from Eric Zimmerman, this really smart guy in the film. He said that, you know, games are these immensely structured things with rules that define very much what you can and cannot do. But inside that very rigid environment is this free-form activity, which we call play. And, you know, when he was describing that to me, I said, gosh, that sounds like classical, it sounds like music. And he said, well, it is, if you think music is a very rigid set of structures, but what do? We play music. It's this opportunity for a deeply creative outlet. And I think that's what's kind of so interesting about games, is that tension between rules and play and the ways in which we can express ourselves through that.
You mentioned your ancestor who helped patent the very first board game in the United States, and you yourself said it was a painfully boring game. That's a really fascinating point that's made at one point in the film, that there was quite a long time where these board games, whatever they were fashioned really with the idea of we must teach our children important lessons, important morals. These must be educational tools. And the idea that, you know, a board game should also be fun and entertaining was just like a foreign concept, apparently. And then at some point, and I think maybe your film is saying that it's the folks at Parker Brothers particularly who kind of figured that out, that, boy, these games better be fun to play as well, or there's no point.
Yeah, that was George Parker's innovation. I mean, my great-grandfather's game was, you know, you avoid sloth and temperance and piety and all these incredibly dull virtues that you were supposed to follow. And George Parker said, games are fun. Games need to be fun. They should be a release. And he often tried to get games that he could, you know, market. And again, he wanted, when he could, a monopoly. And they tried to do it with ping pong, but ended up being undercut because people could just come out with another version of the game that they called table tennis. And the same thing happened with Mahjong, which was a huge craze in the 20s. And Parker Brothers first brought it out and tried to control it, and they couldn't control the market, and it slipped away from them. And those lost opportunities, those games that got away, kind of haunted Parker Brothers. And so when Monopoly came along and they realized that they had a huge hit on their hands, a game that was literally saving their company from bankruptcy during the Depression. And then they discovered that, in fact, Charles Darrow was a fraud and that the game had been invented by a woman in 1904. They had a huge problem on their hands. And they went about this very aggressive campaign, trying to buy up, silence, and co-opt any other games that were based on Monopoly or the landlord's game, Lizzie's game, and control them. It was almost like what happens when the National Enquirer buys an article and then doesn't publish it, a catch-and-kill kind of scenario. And in this case, the great irony is that Parker Brothers was setting out to monopolize the game of Monopoly, which... you can't make this stuff up.
Right, exactly. The irony is just too delicious. Well, of course, yeah. We return to, you know, the person who is such an important figure in your film, Ralph Ansbach, economics professor and a avid anti-monopolist who, as you mentioned earlier, created a game that he called Anti-Monopoly, in a sense a spoof, but I think the word spoof would suggest something playful, and while there is maybe a playful element to it, in fact, he was really wanting to make a very powerful point, and this game is quite popular, and then, of course, as you talk about, he gets a very scary letter from Parker Brothers, essentially a cease and desist, and yeah. That sets in motion then a really vigorous legal battle between Parker Brothers and Ralph Ansbach, who believes that Parker Brothers perhaps does not have the right to claim some kind of ownership over the whole concept of the game of Monopoly, and that his own game of anti-monopoly should be allowed to exist. Can you just say a quick word about how Ralph Ansbach, and I assume his legal team, went about trying to cast doubt on Parker Brothers' hold on the game of Monopoly? I think this is exceptionally interesting.
Mm. Well, at first they just said, look, your trademark infringement claim is absurd. How can you confuse Monopoly with anti-Monopoly? It's the opposite. And trademark law is an extremely slippery and complicated field of law. And for us, waded into the middle of that in the film would have been going down a rabbit hole that really would not have worked and would have been incredibly boring. But what he basically does in the course of his struggle is he starts to uncover this history of the folk game, and he realizes that the game was basically in the public domain. And so anyone claiming a patent on it is basing it on nothing, really. And he digs up some of the people that played the game in the teens and 20s and has them testify in court, and he loses. He has a judge that is very much in favor of corporations, and his first two cases he loses, and he's literally this one guy fighting this massive corporation. Another great irony is that he's taken out three mortgages on his house to fight a monopoly lawsuit, and he's really near the end of his rope and on the brink of ruin. And just as it's going to trial, Parker Brothers and General Mills tries to settle with him, and they offer him a lot of money, and he turns them down. And he is a man of principle, and he is determined to be vindicated at the end of the day. And he fights on, and at the very end, his side wins, and it's really quite wonderful.
By the way, as you tell this story of this long legal battle, there's actually a precious few seconds in which we actually hear audio from some of the testimony of by this point, you know, old Americans, I mean elderly Americans, remembering back many decades to playing the game of Monopoly back in the 1920s and maybe early 30s. And it's just so fascinating how powerful it is just to hear that audio. It just brings it alive in an incredibly dramatic way.
Yeah, thank God that they recorded depositions because that's where we got it from the court process. And it was wonderful to have those folks be kind of brought back out of into the courtroom, in effect, and testimony.
It's an incredible story. Last quick question. Because, you know, you've already talked about, in a sense, your feelings about monopolies, and I'm sure your displeasure with what Parker Brothers got away with for so many, many years. I suspect you have little, if any, affection for the game of Monopoly itself and what it represents and, in a sense, the attitudes it tends to foster. Are you at all concerned that your film is going to, in a sense, revive interest in a game that probably is a little bit set off to the side now in favor of other games that capture our imagination more vividly these days? Is that perhaps one slight drawback to telling this compelling story?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I love Monopoly, and I hope people keep playing it, and I hope they introduce their kids to it, and I hope it promotes great fun and also chaos and sometimes recrimination and tears and everything that usually happens at the end of a very long Monopoly game. I think it's a great part of America. And I think that, you know, General Mills that then became Hasbro, and they have, you know, customized their game now 60 years later so that they're now doing Star Wars Monopoly and Harry Potter Monopoly. There are 300 different kinds of Monopoly out there, and they've turned it into a billion-dollar brand. So I don't think looking back at a period when a big corporation used their sort of bare-knuckle approach to try and control the market is anything to be shied away from. I think it's an important lesson. It's maybe a little bit of a cautionary tale about how America really works and about how corporations tend to operate. And I think if it gives people a little bit of a different perspective on the game when they play it and makes them ask some sort of thoughtful questions about the American system, then I feel like we'll have done our job.
Very well put. The film Ruthless: Monopoly Secret History will air Monday night on the PBS stations across the country, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee, as part of the series American Experience. The writer and director of this wonderful film, Stephen Ives. Stephen Ives, thank you for being my guest today. It was great to reconnect with you, and congrats on a wonderful film.
Always a pleasure, Greg. I really enjoy talking to you. Thanks.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, and that's the podcast version of The Morning Show, yet another archival interview with Dr. Yuri Maltsev, longtime economics professor at Carthage College, who recently passed away. Each Saturday of the month of February, we've been replaying one of our memorable conversations with Professor Maltsev over the years. On Monday's Morning Show, that will be broadcast, of course, you'll be meeting one of the members of a great group called New York Voices. Think Manhattan Transfer. They are a group of that type and of that quality. And they are coming to perform at Carthage College next Thursday evening. We'll meet Darman Meter, the 10th.